The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up for you. I'm Vic McCunis. Today my guest will be Paul Dixon, returning to the program. Paul has written a number of books about baseball, including a very well-received biography of Bill Veeck. And he's just tackled another biography about probably the most colorful character in baseball during the mid part of the 20th century, a guy named Leo Durocher. We'll be talking to Paul Dixon about Leo Durocher, baseball's prodigal son, right after NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Paul Dixon. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Vic. How are you today?
Excellent, Paul. Paul, we've had you on the show a number of times. I guess it's because you write so darn many books, Paul, and you've written another one.
Sure have, yes.
You waited a long time to write a biography, and when you did, you wrote one of the baseball impresario Bill Veeck, and it was quite well received when it came out a few years ago. And now you followed it up with a second baseball biography. How did you decide to write about this particular gentleman?
Well, go back one step. I decided to learn how to write biography in my late 60s. So I decided I would take a new turn of it. So Veeck just loomed large, and this guy just even loomed larger once I got into my head the extent of this man's footprint in baseball, the extent of his career, and the extent to which he was really a phenomenal mid-20th century celebrity. So it's not just a baseball book. It's a book about a guy who was part of the Rat Pack and hung around with George Raft when in Prohibition in New York. I mean, it just goes all through all of these periods and people, and I just needed a big, dynamic character who was not very likable but had some admirable traits.
And who is he? What's his name?
Leo Durocher.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
Leo Durocher. Well, the thing that I noticed, having read the Veeck biography, was that Bill Veeck was a very likable guy.
Yeah.
And you're right. Leo, he's kind of hard to like, particularly as he goes later into life. But let's start at the beginning. Where did this guy come from?
He grew up in West Springfield, Massachusetts. His parents were had immigrated from the French-Canadian, from the Montreal area. And he was brought up as a Roman Catholic in a very predominantly French-Canadian part of the town. He was this French-speaking. And he was born Durocher, but sort of anglicized it to Durocher as he went along. And he was his mother was took in piecework from the Spalding baseball factory. She sewed baseballs for house money.
And Leo, young Leo Durocher, was a was just great character. Baseball player. He was, as a young man, he was a great ball player, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he was, and he played all three. He was a football, basketball, and baseball. And he's playing sort of semi-pro little teams around Western Massachusetts. But then he gets a job at a motorcycle factory a place that made batteries for Indian motorcycles. And there's a black man there named David Redd, who pushes him. He becomes very close friends with David, and pushes him to try out for the Hartford Senators, which at that time was sort of like quasi-farm club for the Yankees. And he pushes and pushes him. DeRocher keeps saying he's not good enough. DeRocher finally ends up getting the position with the Hartford Senators and is immediately scouted by the Cardinals, Cubs, and Yankees.
The book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. Paul Dixon wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And he initially, even though he was a really good shortstop and he was being encouraged by his friend at this battery factory to take the step and play semi-pro ball, he was a little reluctant because he was making good money at the factory, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. For the time, he made very good money. He was, nobody ever said he wasn't industrious and hardworking. He was. And he basically worked. He needed the money. He wanted the money. He was a pool hustler on the side. Played a lot of pool, but played all the different sports. But just, that was, but his ability as a fielder, that's what gave him the job. I mean, at one point that year with the Hartford Senators, he batted 207. He was batting 207. I mean, he was way down. But he was making plays that made headlines in the newspapers. There would be literally headlines saying, DeRocher steals game with magnificent catch or something. He turned what appeared to be a single into a double play. And he just had this amazing range at shortstop, forward, backwards, sideways, and he made amazing plays. And he was extraordinarily fast on that. Once you got him on the bases, he was almost impossible to stop. In fact, one of the All-Star games he played in as a player, he got a home run bunt, which was aided by an error, but he bunted the ball and made it all around the bases home. So that's how fast he was.
And with speed and great fielding, they can overlook maybe the lack of hitting. He did have some good hitting throughout his career, but it was sort of sporadic. And he very quickly made it up to the bigs. And wow, what a story to go from working in a battery factory to playing for the New York Yankees on some great teams with people like Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig.
Yeah, he played his first game in 1925 with the Yankees. They had sent him 2 years in the farm system, once to Atlanta and then St. Paul. But when he comes up with the Yankees, he's unbelievable. He's a loudmouth. He's a spendthrift. He shows up in the hotel lobbies with spats and a cane, and he is immediately going against the grain of the more established Yankees, including Ruth, who he called dummy. When he first games he comes up starting shortstop in the 27th season, the guy he goes after from bench jockeying is Ty Cobb, who's now playing for Philadelphia. So he always went after the big guys. He always went after the sort of a counter bully in those days.
And he had an early mentor with the Yankees. He really liked their coach, didn't he?
Yeah, Miller Huggins was... the reason I called the book The Prodigal Son, every place he goes, he almost destroys his career. And there's always one person that bails him out, one person who believes he can be redeemed. And the first one's Miller Huggins of the Yankees, and who at one point actually talked about rebuilding the 28 Yankees around DeRocher and Gehrig. And that was going to be his team. And he thought a lot of the other guys were dogging it. But he dies before he finishes that season, and the Yankees just get rid of him as soon as they can and send him over to the other league, which in those days was like being sent to, Devil's Island or something. It was nobody got traded to the other league, but it was partly to get him out of the American League. And then he gets to Cincinnati, the Reds, and does very well there, mainly because of a guy named Sidney Weill, who basically bails him out, helps him pay off his gambling debts, helps him pay, really get back on his feet. And that's the second person. Weill is an observant Jewish man who basically believes he can redeem DeRocher. And so that's the second prodigal experience that he has.
Paul, when he came up with the Yankees, being a rookie, he ended up rooming with Babe Ruth. Nobody wanted to room with Babe Ruth because he had some personal distinctions that were not that pleasant.
Yes.
And
yes.
Babe suspected Leo of stealing some of his property, and he never really got over this, did he?
No, in fact, it's, you know, people examined it over the years, and it's who knows what actually happened. But Ruth became absolutely convinced that DeRocher had stolen his watch in the middle of the night, and he went to his grave. The last day he appears, he you know, in a uniform at that final game, and he turns to Pappy Chandler, his then commissioner, and he said, "That DeRocher stole my watch." And for years, the bench jockeys who opposed DeRocher would sit there in the dugout and go tick tock, which was an allusion to that he stole Ruth's watch.
You just mentioned another fellow who became one of DeRocher's nemesis, Happy Chandler, who became the commissioner of baseball. He carried this right to his grave, but we'll get to that later. Let's switch into Cincinnati, because a lot of people are going to want to know, since this is Cincinnati Reds country, about Leo's brief time in Cincinnati. And, man, he was into the gambling in Cincinnati, and this is something that really became a lifelong pursuit.
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting. He would go across the river to the dens of iniquity that were over in Newport, Kentucky, and those little towns around it. And he started – that's where he really – well, in New York, he's already started to line himself up with some shady characters. More this isn't Murder Incorporated, but these are more guys like Memphis Engelberg and some of these – they're bookies and they're bootleggers. But when he gets to Kentucky – he makes the acquaintance of a guy named Sleepout Louie Levinson, who's a notorious denizen of Newport, Kentucky, and he gets very heavily into gambling, and that's where he first meets with Chandler, because Chandler is the governor of Kentucky when he's playing in Cincinnati, and Chandler learned to hate him because he heard that, which was true, that DeRocher had brought his mother from Massachusetts to Cincinnati and got her a job in a hotel as a chambermaid. And while he was knocking down fairly good money and other ballplayers were buying their mothers fur coats and houses, Leo brings his mother west to get her a job in a hotel as a chambermaid. And that's one of that's sort of the beginning of the antagonism between the two guys. But Sidney Weil is the big character here for DeRocher, because Weil is this really beloved guy in Cincinnati, and his memoirs I actually got from the Cincinnati Library, which is a great library. And Weil really saves him. Weil really, you know, keeps getting him out of trouble one jam after another.
And for readers who get to the end of your biography of Leo DeRocher, you have a particularly interesting little tidbit in there about the connection between this gambler, Sleepout, and another notorious Reds gambler named Pete Rose. But they're going to have to read the book to get that little tidbit, because that was really
– That is a true bit of golden truth.
I love that. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. This morning, my guest is Paul Dixon. His book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. And I'll continue my conversation with Paul right after this. My guest is Paul Dixon. His book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. After the Reds, was it the Cardinals next?
Yeah, he goes to the Cardinals, and this is the famous Gas House Gang, and he immediately is very popular. He was popular in Cincinnati. The fans loved him. He put on a great show. He got into squabbles, but he was a very colorful character. When he gets to the Gas House Gang, he becomes one of the guys. In fact, he claims he names the Gas House Gang. The term actually was named after the gas house in Springfield, which is across the river from his house. But when he gets there, president is Branch Rickey, who again does everything he can to protect Leo and helps him get out of Diablo. And again, it's another religious man. Weil was an observant Jew. Here comes Branch Rickey, who's an observant Methodist to the point where he won't attend baseball games on the Sabbath, even though he's the general manager of the team. But again, the theme of these guys are going to save Leo from himself. And through Branch Rickey, he meets this amazing woman named Grace Dozier. It's his second marriage. Mm. But she is just a wonderful woman who everybody loves. She's a dress designer and a very famous dress designer with much more fame at that point than DeRocher, and is a it makes more, you know, a lot more money than Leo does. And she helps straighten him out as well. But he's perfect for the Gas House Gang, and he brags, rest of his life he'll brag that when he got the ball from the pitcher, he would rub it against his belt buckle, which was sharpened like a knife, and he'd gouge the ball, and he'd hand it back to the pitcher, and the pitcher would then have a ball to throw that would do dipsy-doodle
mm-hmm.
because it had this deep gouge in it. But they loved to cheat. They loved practical jokes. They relished in the fact that they wore dirty uniforms and had ripped, you know, blouses and such. But they were themselves. I mean, they were, and it was in the depths of the Depression, and sort of America adopted them as their team. They were the hard luck guys, the guys from the wrong side of the tracks, or they behaved that way. Mm. And they sort of became America's darling. And of course, you had the Dean brothers leading the whole pack, and their comic wisdom it was part of that too.
You just mentioned Branch Rickey when he was with the Cardinals. Of course, he's probably best known as the guy who brought Jackie Robinson up to break the color line in baseball with the Brooklyn Dodgers. We had the late Jimmy Breslin on the program a few years ago when he wrote a biography of Branch Rickey. And yeah. Branch Rickey was the guy who brought Leo east to New York City, back east. He went from playing with the Yankees to a few years later, he was playing with the Dodgers.
Yep. And he trades him. He really realizes that's where his big future is going to be in Brooklyn. And Rickey, he actually even foretells that Leo will become a manager. And, of course, shortly after he arrives in Brooklyn, he becomes player-manager, and that's in 39, and he immediately becomes a major figure in baseball, not just as a player, but as a sort of a very antagonistic, fight the umpires kind of manager, and be much beloved in Brooklyn. He sort of fit the temperament of Brooklyn. I mean, when he gets there, somebody looks at Leo and said, ask him if he's Jewish, and Leo said no, but he said DeRocher rhymes with kosher. So he sort of fit in with the sort of the comics, the famous comedians who came out of Brooklyn, like Danny Kaye, who was a very close friend of his in Brooklyn. And they went on during the war to do a lot of, you know, entertaining the troops overseas.
He loved hanging out with the Hollywood types. And one of his best friends was a guy named George Raft, who got him into some considerable troubles, a real jam involving gambling.
Yeah, I mean, it was clear that DeRocher met, they first met DeRocher first went to New York, and Raft was still at that time a song and dance with the studios. He hadn't even gone to Hollywood yet, when he gets to New York full time, DeRocher later, you know, with the Brooklyn Dodgers, they share houses. Raft stays in DeRocher's apartment for part of the winter. They spend other times in Hollywood together, and more Raft is getting involved in gambling, and he has what it calls a nodding acquaintance with some of the big time gamblers. I mean, even the Murder Incorporated guys like Bugsy Siegel and mm-hmm. the big organized crime guys. And he drags Leo along with him, and Leo has idolized Raft to the point where they dressed identically. There are pictures of them with the same tailor, you know, making the suits for them. So they're tailored to the same degree, the suits for the two guys, and they were about the same size.
And Leo had expensive tastes, and he wasn't really good at paying his bills. But let's segue into his management, because, man, was he a great manager. And he was an early adopter of a practice that was virtually unknown in baseball, which was platooning players.
Yeah, he had everything going for him in that respect. When Rickey finally comes over to Brooklyn, the team is really, really good, but it's also damaged because he's allowed. Leo's allowed the clubhouse, the dugout, to be loaded with gamblers and bookies, and so there are pitchers coming off the mound into the dugout and turning to a bookie who's behind the players in the dugout, saying, "Put $50 on such and such a horse at Hialeah." And when Ricky comes in, he clears that all out, and from then DeRocher really starts to become. Ricky forces him to clean up his act. And Ricky's believed that one of the reasons they didn't win the World Series earlier was because of the level of gambling that was going on. And he becomes a really brilliant manager, and he sees the value in certain players. And he's a very, very Pete Reiser, for example, and others. He really works for these guys. And then, of course, at some point, 39, when he first becomes manager, he starts mouthing off about the powers that be will not let him bring in players from the Negro Leagues in America or the dark-skinned Cubans that he wants to bring up and put in on the Dodgers. And he said he blames it on the hierarchy of baseball. So from 39 on, he becomes a major advocate for the integration of baseball.
And he should have been Jackie Robinson's first manager, but he got himself in a lot of trouble, and by the time he was coaching Robinson, they didn't get along.
Yeah, I mean, he gets suspended for a year for a whole lot of reasons, including the intervention of a Supreme Court justice who basically wrote to the Dodgers and said Chandler saying he should be suspended because he was a moral outrage to American youth and such. But yeah, when he finally gets to Robinson, who he's really encouraged and protected, when he finally gets to manage him in 48, they just fall apart. He hates Robinson for the fact that he's put on some weight over the winter. He starts calling him fatso. Robinson is convinced that DeRocher is a sort of a, he calls him a cologne-soaked bully. He sees him as a dandy who spends too much time in nightclubs and too much time on fancy clothes. And, you know, they're just two different lifestyles. It wasn't racial, the energy between them. It was a difference between two sort of high-energy guys who just didn't like the way the other person led their lives. And, of course, Robinson was the guy who sort of went home at night to his wife and kids and mowed the lawn, whereas DeRocher was running up and down Broadway, getting his name in the gossip columns. It's fascinating. And they finally, later, the feud intensifies over the years, and after DeRocher's gone to the Giants, and then later they finally reconcile, but it takes a long time.
Paul Dixon joins us. His biography is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. You just mentioned he goes over to the Giants. Leo did all kinds of strange things, didn't he? I mean, he went from the American League to the National League. Nobody did that. And then he goes from the Dodgers to the Giants. And, man, he had some great teams with the Giants, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, the other thing that happens to me, I think this is his great transformation. I think when he was at Brooklyn, when he first started managing, he did a lot of sort of intimidating his own players. You know, a guy would come up as a rookie and he'd give him heat and, you know, wouldn't bond with him especially. And some people thought he was a rough manager and didn't like the way he treated his own players. When he gets to the Giants in 49, he's really starting to change. But when he really changes, he gets these two guys, both African-American. One is Henry Thompson and one is Monty Irvin. And Thompson had been in the Battle of the Bulge in a combat, and Monty Irvin had gone in on the third day of the D-Day invasion of Europe. And he realized he had these guys who were combat veterans, and he couldn't treat them like two kids out of some small town who he could push around and stuff. And he realized, and these guys, they just weren't going to take it. They'd seen their friends die and stuff. And to them, baseball was nothing more than a game. And he gave Leo perspective. So by the time he gets Willie Mays a year later, he's totally become the nurturing manager, and he takes Mays under his wing and says, you know, no matter how many strikeouts you do, you're going to be my guy. You're going to be one of the greatest players in baseball. And Mays just absolutely flowers under this treatment, because he really knew. He was from a very small town, very sheltered life. And Mays is the one ball player to speak at DeRocher's funeral and say, you know, this man was the father I never had. And I think he transforms himself with the Giants. I think he becomes he's really at his best with the Giants. And he creates these wonderful teams in there. You know, of course, the Bobby Thompson home run and the miracle in 1951. So it's probably the high point of his managerial career.
He nurtured Willie Mays and let him become the fabulous player who made the catch, who made the throw, these highlights that we still see years later as the most spectacular fielding plays ever. And also that game you just alluded to, that probably most famous playoff game ever, Leo saw it tainted a little bit by accusations that they were stealing signs in a very sophisticated way. Of course, stealing signs was normal, but they went to extremes, supposedly.
Yeah, I don't think they were all going to extremes. I mean, you know, Bob Feller brought back a telescope from the cruiser he'd been on in World War II, and they were stealing by telescope. But I think the actual Thompson home run was not stolen. In fact, I think I can prove it because because Whitey Lockman was on second, and Lockman says there's no way you could have stolen the signs from the outfield and transmitted them back, because when there's a man on second, the opposing catcher is not just throwing down simple signals; he's coding the signals. So the signal may not be your fingers. It may be the way you touch your eyebrow. So he said there was no way to break that code, and he was on second base. He said, I couldn't make that call. Now, and that's when the first time this ball broke out. So I'm convinced that everybody was stealing, everybody had a system, but the particular call on that shot, the famous Bobby Thompson, could not have been picked from somebody in the bleachers. If the guy on second, the runner on second base couldn't pick it. And Whitey Lockman was known for his ability to decode signs.
And if it had been passed along that way, he would have swung at the first pitch, because that was looking pretty fat and juicy, wasn't it?
It sure was. And it was the same pitch.
He was a great baseball player. He was a fabulous baseball manager. He was quite a colorful character. His name was Leo DeRocher. I'll continue my conversation with Paul Dixon about Leo right after this. My guest is Paul Dixon. His book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. Let's talk about Leo's love life, because that's a big part of the story.
Yeah. I mean, he had four wives, and he was seen with and hung around with many other actresses. I mean, and movie stars and you name it. His first wife was sort of lost in the midst of history. She'd already disappeared after they divorced with a child who was basically name was changed and sort of lost track of everywhere. The second wife was this Grace Dozier, was just this wonderful woman that everybody loved and they were a beautiful couple. I mean, the way they dressed, and she was a designer. She actually helped Leo dress, turned him into a fashion plate. And then, of course, his next marriage is to Lorraine Day, the movie actress, who is a very, very attractive, especially to maybe a teenage boy of those era. Uh-huh. And she played traditionally against John Wayne. And after Leo and Lorraine got married, John Wayne and Lorraine were in a movie. And Leo had gone out every day and they started embracing or kissing on the set, you know, during the filming of the movie. Leo would get all pacing around, get all upset. And finally, Wayne had to have him banned from the studio. And Wayne told the biographer much later that he said that Leo had really made him nervous and ruined some of the kissing scenes in the movie they were making, which is called Tycoon. So here he is intimidating John Wayne. He intimidates Ty Cobb. He intimidates, you know, it's. But they separate, and then he gets remarries again in Chicago, and all along he's been involved with various suits, and there some of them pretty hilarious, of women suing because of alienation of affection, or men husbands suing, and he gets in the famous battle with Zsa Zsa Gabor, which is acted out on the Johnny Carson show. So and what's odd about my book is, it's hard to call it a baseball book when you go to the index and it's got Greta Garbo, Judy Garland, Mr. Ed the Talking Horse, and all these other people in the back of it. But he was apparently, he was very attractive to women, and he was, part of it was his wit. He had virtually no education. He never even went to high school, but he had this amazing ability to be funny, have comic timing. And when he would go on these USO tours, he had them rolling in the aisles. He and Danny Kaye would go up, and Danny Kaye said sometimes Leo got more laughs than he did, and Kaye was a leading comedian.
John Wayne was smart to close the movie set and keep Lorraine's husband out of there, because he had a reputation for fisticuffs, and I'm just picturing Leo trying to duke the Duke.
You know, Leo got in a lot of fights, and I would be an interesting. It would have been a little bit of a David and Goliath situation, but
yeah. Let's talk about some of the Hollywood stuff, because after we're not done with the baseball stuff actually, but let's talk a little bit about the Hollywood stuff if you've got time, because
sure.
He got a big career going in television and in radio. He was in demand. He was making lots of money.
When he leaves the New York Giants, the next day he's hired by NBC for $75,000 a year, which was unheard of at that time. And his major job was talent coordinator. So he'd been really probably closest guy there was to Sinatra. He would, for NBC, he would get Sinatra to show up and appear on some of the NBC shows. He hosts the Comedy Hour against Ed Sullivan back in the black and white era for a couple little period of time. But he's on all the shows. And by the end of it all, he becomes Mr. Hollywood. He's in every major sitcom. You know, Mr. Ed, the Munsters, the Beverly Hillbillies. He goes on the Judy Garland show a lot. All the variety shows have him on. And he's sort of back in that period. He shows up with people like Jonathan Winters and Ernie Kovacs as a comic. And he plays the comic role. Even though his baseball reputation is a fierce, umpire-baiting sort of tough guy. But he loves Hollywood. He loves the whole... He's the first player in the game of the week. And he loves that role, too.
And he loved getting in trouble and controversy, and Danny Kaye got him into some hot water by at a roast doing an imitation of I believe it was the owner of the Dodgers who apparently had a drinking problem.
Yep.
It was the Giants, and he had a drinking problem, and Danny Kaye kind of went overboard that night, didn't he?
Yeah, the easiest way to describe it. It was a lewd. Interpretation of Horace Stoneham in a drunken rage, and somebody videotaped it or kinescoped it in those days, and it got back to Stoneham, and Stoneham came to the Rocher and said, "You were part of this." He said, no, I was just watching," but he was laughing at the whole thing, and that's when they broke up. But his he just loved that. He just loved being in trouble. Not that he looked for trouble, but he loved being in situations which could lead to controversy. The fact that he was, when he ends up with the Chicago Cubs in the late 60s, he's taking calls in the dugout from the Rat Pack. Dean Martin will call him in the dugout in the middle of a game, and he'll be talking to Dean Martin. So that part of him, he becomes, you know, the celebrity guy. He's on all the talk shows. You know, even this lawsuit, million-dollar lawsuit against Zsa Zsa Gabor, Zsa Zsa and Leo fight it out on the Johnny Carson show, not in the courts. Settle at a court.
By the time Leo became manager of the Cubs, he was past his prime as a manager, and the Cubs had some good teams, but Leo's managing really kind of wrecked their hopes. Instead of platooning players, he was letting them play on those hot summer days, those hot day games at Wrigley. And he was particularly nasty to Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks. This was appalling to me as a reader. He's hard to like later in life.
He's difficult to like. He picks. It's almost like wherever he goes, if somebody's got a bigger piece of the spotlight than he does, that's his enemy. And then he gets to Chicago, almost from day one, it's Ernie Banks, and he goes after him, and he tries to get him off the team, and Banks just keeps coming back with hitting and with popularity. And he deeply resented Banks' popularity. And Banks at one point goes to his mother and says, "What can I do? This man hates me." And his mother says, "You'll just have to just keep performing and turn the other cheek." And, you know, he does the same thing with Ron Santo. When Santo in 1970, after they've lost the pennant in 1969 when the Mets overtake them for the pennant, in 70 they have a clubhouse revolt. It's the second one that Leo's had with his own players. And in this one, Santo tries to choke him. He gets his arm around his neck, and the feeling was, among others in the clubhouse, that he would have killed DeRocher if they hadn't pulled him off. But then he finally gets to the Houston Astros. By this time, he hates the players, he hates their union, he hates their salaries, he hates the fact that they're tending to be more and more well educated, more and more independent, more and more less likely to take his abuse and go off in the corner and sulk. Now they're saying, "Skip, you know, forget it." And he hated that. And when he really hated it in Houston, he'd go up to the players. He said, "Well, I had dinner with Frank last night," and they all in unison yell out, "Frank who?" And of course, he would drive him crazy because he was, of course, alluding to Frank Sinatra.
And there was a great irony in the fact that he was so hostile to the players' union and the players receiving benefits after they retired, because here's a guy who'd been in baseball for so long that he was drawing the biggest pension allowable as a baseball player.
Yep. And of course, it had been Happy Chandler, his nemesis, who had started that. And maybe the players, that money, and may have been one of the reasons the owners got rid of Chandler, was because he had started this whole business by taking all of the television radio receipts from the World Series and turning them over to the Players Association for pensions. And a lot of the owners really were stunned by that he'd set up this pension system.
Philip Wrigley.
So he was, yeah.
Philip Wrigley, the owner of the Cubs, defended Leo for a long time, but he finally just got sick of him, and Leo essentially was fired from that job. And so he was desperate to stay in baseball, and he got one last chance to be the manager of a team that played in the Astrodome, a place that Leo despised.
That's right. It was the ultimate irony of because he'd spent so many years rallying, screaming about the Astrodome and insulting the people there and ripping up turf and throwing things on the field, and he just, everything about it he hated, and then he ends up being there. And it could have been a great swan song if he had just stopped. He really had a hard time with guys like Larry Durker, who were with the Astros at the time and were just genuinely good guys who were smart. And Leo resented that. Leo's resented these smart, modern, college-educated players. He had them before, but he never. It became almost like a threat to him as he got older, and it's really sad to see, because he had brilliant moments. A couple people have, one critic has already said I should have done some diagnosis in the book and said what I thought was wrong, whether it was inferiority complex or whatever. And I said, no, I don't do that.
Mm.
I write the book, I tell you the story, and I'll let the reader decide if they want to come up with a diagnosis.
The book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. Paul Dixon wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And if you're into baseball, Paul has written widely about baseball, and you really need to track down all of his books, including the Dixon Baseball Dictionary. What an incredible work. And Leo, as he goes into the twilight, after he's out of baseball, he's getting older, the one thing that he really wants is the same thing that Pete Rose really wants. He wants to be inducted in the Hall of Fame while he's alive. And this is the saddest, most pathetic part of the book. Poor Leo.
It is sad. And he's got people working for him. Monty Irvin, who I interviewed before Monty died, about DeRocher. I interviewed him about Vec as well. But you could not get Monty to say a negative word about Leo DeRocher. He was like Mays. He just saw him as the great man who respected them. But even with that, he had all these other people fighting against him. People like Jack Brickhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people he'd alienated in Chicago really went after trying to keep him out. And it was only when enough people had passed away that he finally makes it in. And the Hollywood ending, of course, is when Lorraine Day, who had been his third wife, accepts his induction, accepts his plaque. And she says, and it is the Hollywood ending, she said, he wasn't a bad guy. It was all an act. He was just an actor on the stage. And this is the role he played. And he loved kids, and he loved this, and he loved that. But he just played the role of this character. And it was a fascinating ending because that was the last word anybody really had that was close to him about him.
I think the saddest part for me about him hoping and praying to make it in the Hall of Fame while he was alive, which he did not, was the fact that he had alienated Happy Chandler. And here's Happy Chandler in his 90s, still on the Veterans Committee every year saying, no, I don't want that guy in the Hall of Fame, and single-handedly keeping him out.
Yep. And that was a battle that was fierce. And Chandler, towards the end, Chandler wrote his own memoirs and ended up attacking everybody who breathed, I think. I don't know why he did that, but he was after the New York writers. And Chandler always felt he had moved the commissioner's office to Cincinnati, and that had really bothered the writers and such. And they felt that the commissioner should either be in New York or Chicago and sort of be where they were. The bulk of the writers were in those two cities, not in Cincinnati. But it was an interesting story. And somebody asked me the other day, what is your final feeling about DeRocher? And I said, well, I suppose if I was on a plane and I had the first class seat and they sat me next to DeRocher, I'd call the flight attendant over and I'd say, can I get, is there a seat left in coach for me? I mean, I think he was that abrasive.
Uh-huh.
And especially with somebody who was in his way.
Hmm.
You know, I think he, if I had been Greta Garbo sitting next to him or some, you know, Jeff Chandler or Spencer Tracy, all of whom were great friends of his, or Jackie Gleason, that'd be another story. But if I was just some guy, some writer with ink on his elbows and stuff, he'd be totally dismissive.
Well, Paul, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Beck, it is my great pleasure to be with you.
The book is Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. How many books is it now, Paul?
We're up in the mid-60s. So,
what are you working on?
I've always wanted to do a World War II book, so I'm working on, I think I've got a new cut at a World War II book about the 1940 draft and how they got this Million Man Army ready before Pearl Harbor, which nobody's ever really written about. And these huge maneuvers in Louisiana and Kentucky and Carolinas that got everybody ready and got Patton ready, and Eisenhower came out of the mix at that point. It's about a draftee army, which people forget that's what won World War II. It wasn't the regulars. It was the 11 million that we drafted.
I'll watch out for it, Paul. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vic.
And it is such a pleasure to interview Paul Dixon. He's appeared on the program a number of times, and he's written widely about baseball. And the new book is Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. And I'm going to close out the program today by reading just a little excerpt from the book, near the end of the book, near the end of the life of Leo Durocher. Durocher was not in the Hall of Fame class of inductees in 1977 or 1978. Meanwhile, Larry McPhail's contributions to the game earned him election to the Hall in 1978, 3 years after his death. Along with the disappointment of not getting into the Hall of Fame, Durocher lost the last of his brothers, Armand, in the fall of that year. The obituary in the Springfield Union said that he had worked for some years as a chef. No mention was made of his criminal record. Willie Mays was elected in 1979 and made a point of pushing for Durocher's enshrinement in his acceptance speech. Mays' lobbying had little or no effect, as Leo was again rejected in 1980 and 1981. The constant rejection had an effect. After the 1981 rejection, Leo silenced himself and refused to give interviews of any kind. Confronted by Phil Elderkin of the Christian Science Monitor in the lobby of the Sheraton Plaza Resort and Racquet Club in Palm Springs, Leo said, "I am retired. I am no longer in baseball. I have no opinions on anything, and I no longer give interviews. I'm at home here in the desert with my wife and friends, and I don't need any publicity." But the claim about his wife was untrue. Leo and Lynn had been living apart since 1977, and later in 1981 they were divorced and had not spoken since. The event created no press and was handled quietly. In the meantime, Leo was seeing younger women and would continue to do so for as long as he was able. According to Gerald Eskenazi's 1993 biography, The Lip, Leo received a penile implant in 1987 in a Brooklyn hospital where he was accompanied by a much younger woman named Jeannie. Eskenazi suggested that the procedure was paid for by Frank Sinatra. Leo only spoke out on rare occasions. Some weeks after declaring himself a private man, he broke his silence to label the player strike then in progress as stupid. That's all stupid. Just before Thanksgiving, Leo showed up in Manhattan for the opening night of a play about Jackie Robinson called The First. According to the New York Times, Durocher got the biggest hand at the theater, bigger than some of the old Dodgers present, including Duke Snider and Ralph Branca. The Times noted that he lived in retirement in Palm Springs, California, but New York was always Durocher's town. In an interview after the play, he told a reporter that he really wanted a chance to work for George Steinbrenner, the owner of the New York Yankees, who was probably as disliked by as many fans as Durocher was. It was not going to happen, but it got Leo Inc. in New York. A few months later, Steinbrenner came to a point where he demanded Yankee managers who fought with umpires. "Don't tell me baiting umps doesn't do any good," he told Dick Young in April 1982, after he replaced the easygoing Bob Lemon with a more contentious Gene Michael. "All the winning managers are baiting managers," Young then commented. That's George Steinbrenner, Leo Durocher, with money. In 1982, Durocher was again left out of the Hall of Fame, but Happy Chandler was elected. It came as a complete surprise, or as Joe Durso of the New York Times put it, in electing Chandler, the committee executed one of the more remarkable reversals since voting for the Hall of Fame began in 1936. Durocher began thinking more and more of his exclusion, feeling that he deserved induction. Leo's appearances on television became fewer and fewer in the 1980s. But when he did appear, he could still generate sparks. In 1982, while appearing with NBC TV broadcaster Bob Costas during a Cubs-Padres game, DeRocher was in fine fettle when talk got around to the 1954 World Series and the heroics of the Giants' Dusty Rhodes. "That bum," Leo said, "I couldn't give him away for a dollar. All I could think of was getting that drunken bum off my back." After a commercial break, DeRocher said, "I'm not allowed to say that on television, am I?" "You already said it," Costas replied. "Well, I worked for NBC before," Leo quipped. "That's why they fired me." What a great book. An excerpt from Paul Dixon's Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. You heard about it on the Book Nook. Thanks, as always, for listening.